We are continuing with our series looking at Proverbs today, and we come to a passage all about getting wisdom. After you have finished your training as a Baptist minister, you become what is called a NAM, a newly accredited minister. And so in 2016, I found myself at Didcot in a room with 50, 60 other people. And someone stood at the front, picked up a guitar, and led us in a time of sung worship. And they began singing that well-known 80s classic, Shine, Jesus, Shine. We got to that part in the song where we sang Shine on Me. And without prompting, without leading, no one had told us to do this, no one had planned it, no one orchestrated it, 60 people spontaneously went... And we all looked at each other thinking, why did we just do that? Why did all of us, at once, with no one telling us what to do, how to do it, when to do it, clap in exactly the same way? And someone leant over to me and went, did that just happen? And I said, yes. And he said, I've never experienced ironic clapping before. And I don't think Graham Kendrick was trying to plant a subliminal message when he wrote his classic Shine, Jesus, Shine. But I think we as humans are very good at remembering certain triggers. When something happens, you respond in a certain way. When someone says one word, you respond in a certain way. When someone sings Shine on Me, anyone who was in church pre the 2005 Graham Kendrick cull would go... And you don't know why. It's just what you do. This ability of humans to respond instinctively to a certain phrase or a certain thing is well understood by speechwriters, authors throughout the years. It was definitely understood by the writers of the Old Testament. I've been here nearly a year now, and one passage I mentioned probably more than others is Deuteronomy 6. Verse 4. It is called the Shema. It is one of the most significant passages in the entirety of the Old Testament for the Jewish faith, for their scriptures, I should say. It's called the Shema for that first word, hear, Shema Yisrael, and so on and so forth. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. It was Moses' final speech as he stood on the rocks in front of the hordes before him, having led them out of slavery, having led them for 40 years through the wilderness to the edge of the promised land, he stood and gave them one final sermon. It was a plea to take seriously that God was going to give them a gift of the land of Canaan, a gift that if they used wisely, if they listened to what had been commanded of them, it would be a gift that brought them abundant life. Moses reminded them of what God had done for them, what God would continue to do for them, of a faithful God who was with them day and night. He would command them to share this story with one another, to write it down, to bind it to themselves, to live lives that would honor God, to, as it concludes, that it may go well with you. Moses was making a very clear line. Live a life that honors God, and things will go well for you. This was the foundational moment in the life of the nation of Israel. It was such a well-known passage that they would quote it time and time again, so that any time anyone began a sentence with Shema, instantly they would be transported back. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. I mention it this morning because the passage that we have just heard in Proverbs 4 begins with that word, Shema. Listen, O my sons. This chapter in Proverbs is essentially one whole trigger for the people of Israel to know that the Lord their God, the Lord is one, that he is with them, that he has guided them, that he has commanded them to live lives that would honor him, be faithful unto him, that it may go well with them. So this morning we are going to look at how this wonderful passage in Proverbs can help us know that God is God, to know what God has done for us, that we may know how to honour God with our lives, that it may go well for us. The first 9 verses, 1-9, sound a bit like that Cat Stevens song, Father and Son. I realise all my references only work if you're over 40. I apologise to anyone else. But it does sound like that song. It's a well-known song. I'm sure many of you know it. Cat Stevens plays both parts, the dad trying to pass on his wisdom to the son telling his dad to shut up and just let him get on with his life. And these verses can read a bit like that. The wise old man saying, listen, my sons, I listened to my father and he listened to his before him. Listen to what I have to say. But it is part of life and part of our nature to believe that the older generation doesn't know what it is talking about. And we get to a certain age where we think the younger generation doesn't know what it's talking about, forgetting that we thought that the generation above us didn't know what they were talking about, and we go on in this cycle until we all reach a certain age and give up hope. But that's what happens. And in the 20th century, in the 20s, there was the flappers and jazz music that horrified the previous generation. Then came rock and the swinging 60s and then long hair and goodness knows what we did in the 90s. I think we were all just depressed. And these days, I don't know what the generation of youngsters is into because I'm not one of them. Grunting seems to make a large part of it, but maybe we all grunted as teenagers and we just forgot as we grew. We are all capable, as humans, of dismissing the past because it was the past. Because that was then, and this is now, and that means nothing to us. Equally, we are all capable of revering the past, of being nostalgic and dewy-eyed. My mom's here today. Everyone say hello to Esther. Hello, Esther. There we go, that'll embarrass her. I would say stand up, but it wouldn't make much difference. She's very short. But my mum's mum always used to talk about the 50s as this sort of golden era. Always used to say, oh, it's not like it used to be. Even darts wasn't the same once we got into the 90s and Keith Deller wasn't around. And just this yearning back for a time when things were better. But that's because that's when we were in our prime. Life is always better when you're in your 20s and 30s. You don't ache as much. You walk into a room and know why you walked into it. You're just in a better place than you were. And so the past will always be the time when things were better. Human nature, that is how we work. We distrust those that went before us because they don't get us. And we're suspicious of the youngsters because they haven't learned from experiences. And the warning comes loud and clear in this passage. Yes, wisdom can be gained from experience. You can gain wisdom as you go through life and collect it and put it in a file. You can also gain wisdom by learning from others, looking around and seeing what is going on. But wisdom is more than that. It is more than just experience. It is more than learning new things. Wisdom goes beyond time, boundaries. It goes beyond generations. In fact, so far above all human effort is wisdom that it leads the writer to write surely the least helpful phrase in the entirety of Scripture. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. That is the equivalent of me writing a book called How to Swim the Channel. Step 1, swim the channel. It is not a helpful, insightful, or profound statement, but I don't think the writer is trying to be sarcastic or unhelpful. They're simply highlighting that wisdom goes above and beyond any effort we can make, any life experience we can call on. And because our brains can't cope with that, because we are mere humans, the writer of Proverbs attempts to bring it down to a language we can understand, a And so we see through this chapter and through the next few chapters, wisdom becomes personified. It is given human characteristics. And in this first part of the passage, it is given the characteristic of a woman who will love you and cherish you. And in return, we are called to love and cherish and embrace wisdom. Wisdom is given human characteristics that we might truly value it, not see it as a thing to do or an activity to undertake, but something that is living and breathing and available for us all, which surely leads to a very obvious question: what on earth is wisdom? And verses 10 to 19 then start to unpack how do we begin to understand this word. If in the first passage the writer personifies wisdom as a woman, in this passage he personifies wisdom as a light, something that will guide our path. Psalm 119 says, "Your word is a lamp for my feet, a light on my path." And the writer of the Psalms is trying to help us see that when light is given, it is for a purpose. When a path is laid out in front of us, there is a destination in mind. When God speaks, it is to direct us, to guide us, to take us along safe and life-giving paths. Wisdom is that word of God, as a wise and profound person said last week, one that should have love and faithfulness written on our hearts. Wisdom is given that we may know what God has asked of us. Verse 18 in this passage says this: "The path of the righteous is like the morning sun, shining ever brighter till the full light of day." Because this light is not an open-ended, generic, let's do what feels good, let's go down the path that seems best to us. There is a fixed point at the end of this path to which we are all being drawn. There is a purpose of heading down this path for the whole of the people of God. Wisdom is designed to guide you towards something specific. And what the writer has in mind is that wisdom is designed to get us to the heart of God. It is why there are so many appeals to avoid those other paths, those perilous, dangerous, non-life-enriching paths. This is not about bashing others or feeling superior that we always get it right as Christians. But it is to state that God has spoken. And when God has spoken, it means there is a path laid out in front of us that we can follow. For the Israelite communities, God spoke through the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets were given that they may know God, that they may know God's heart, that they may know what God has commanded of them, that they may know what God has done for them. Of course, for us as Christians, God has spoken through Jesus. We know what it is that God has done for us. We know the story that we are commanded to share. We know the path that God walked in order to light the way for us. So we are to value wisdom. We are to get wisdom. And that wisdom is designed to draw us to God. But how on earth do we know? How do we know that this is the right path and that is not? How do we know that this is the way to go, that this is the heart of God? Well, that really is the story of the Old Testament. And if you read through it, that is the battle, the challenge that is laid out through the whole of the history of Israel. How can such mortals know this is what God has asked us to be? I always thought when I read the Old Testament for the first time that it must have been a lot easier in those days. If you wanted to know what God had said, you'd simply send Moses up the mountain. He'd hear the audible voice of God. He'd come down glowing like David Dickinson and say, "Thus saith the Lord," and speak exactly what God had said. And I would have thought if that had happened, that I would go, "Yes, that is what we should do. This is easy." But of course, as you read the Old Testament, that doesn't seem to make a blind bit of difference. God can speak loudly, clearly, with his Old Testament smiting us to the fore, and still the people of God will go, I'm not listening. I will do things my way. I will choose what's good for me. And the book of Judges is the ultimate example of that. And at least half a dozen times in the book of Judges, it leads with this horrible phrase, everyone did what they saw was right in their own eyes. By the time we get to Jeremiah and the prophets, this experiment of Israel as a beacon to everyone else to draw them to the heart of God, as Karen shared earlier, to be an example to the nations around them and go, this is who God is. This is what God wants. This is who God has called us to be. That experiment has failed miserably. The people are in exile, abandoned by God. God has definitely been abandoned by them. And all those things that they had to help them know God, all those lights on the path that they felt were drawing them to the heart of God, their laws, their rituals, the temple, the sacrifices, the festivals, and so on, they were not enough. They had not drawn them closer to God. And so in Jeremiah, God speaks of a future where laws and temples and festivals and rituals will not be the defining factor. They will not be the thing that draws us to the heart of God. In a famous passage in Jeremiah 31, he says this, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel, with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them. This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds. I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people." The writer of Proverbs, and there's a debate whether this was written before the exile, after the exile, it neither matters. The same Spirit inspired them to understand that the important thing was to have God's law, God's heart, inscribed on our own. And this passage in chapter 4 has perhaps one of the most well-known lines in Proverbs, other than a dripping touch like a nagging wife, which we don't talk about anymore. But it has the most famous line, "Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life." The writer is aware that if we are to truly know the heart of God, then it is our hearts that need changing, our hearts that need transforming, our hearts that need to beat in time with God's heart. For in the ancient world, the heart was the place of cold stone logic. It was not the emotional, it was not the lovey-dovey feeling part of the body. The heart was where you made decisions that affected everything else. In the ancient world, it was the stomach that was the emotional part of you, and we have a bit of lingering bit of that. You talk about our gut instinct because you feel it. One of my favorite words in Greek in the New Testament is the word for compassion. It's a great word. It's splagnicthmai, and it's meant to be this onomatopoeic word that sounds like your stomach is exploding in pain as you look upon someone's situation. But in the ancient world, the heart was the place of decision-making, the place where you stopped, you paused, and chose which path to walk down. It is the place where health and well-being sprang from. Having the law written on your heart is the way of saying your whole life should be orientated, completely transformed. Who you are and what you do should change. And the rest of the body is there to guard it. Your mouth, your lips, your tongue, your eyes, your ears, they're all gateways. They can allow things in that speak of goodness, of godliness, of love and grace and peace. Or they can allow things in that lead you down another path. They can let in godly wisdom or distractions from the path. And I wanted to end on a little note of caution and practical application, if at all possible, when you come to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs is not a self-help book. Proverbs is not there to make your life easier. Proverbs, in fact, was not written to you at all. In fact, it was written to a community who had no understanding of I, me, or myself. It was not a book that was designed to make one person's life better, richer, or fuller. Valuing wisdom is not about getting you more stuff or having an easier life. Godly wisdom does not ask, what does God want of me? Godly wisdom asks, what does God want us to be as a community? If our wisdom is to faithfully reflect God's wisdom, then it must value what God values. And that really is the challenge that's laid down by this passage, laid down by that passage in Deuteronomy, laid down by the law and the prophets. Do we value that which God values? What do we know about those things that God values? From the beginning, we know that God values life. God did not have to create us. He did not have to create anything. God chose to create. We know that God values community. When he called Abraham, it was to be a father of nations, not nation. When he heard the cries of in slavery, he rescued a nation from Egypt. God has always valued people, life, community. God did not ask, how can I do that for one person? There's that great passage in Genesis with Abraham and God having an argument. God values community, being together, loving one another, putting one another first. If wisdom is about valuing what God values, it's about daring to walk the path that God has walked. So what path has God walked? What do we know of God's story? This was the great command to the people of Israel. Know the story of God, that you may live it out. And I refer back to Karen's epic talk again. We know that God walked a path of great cost and sacrifice. We know that he walked a path that led to all creation being reconciled back to himself through Jesus. We know that he walked a path that did not consider his own needs, desires, or glory first, but humbled himself and became nothing. This is a story that should be written on our hearts. This is a story that should be so well known to us that our natural instincts should kick in. That whenever we think about what path to choose, we naturally, like the people in Israel hearing the word Shema, would know this is the path to choose. We know the path that God has walked. That whenever we stop and think, well, what would God value in this situation? That we would stop and as instinctively as clapping when we hear the word shine on me, know that God has called us to value life, community, one another. Getting wisdom is about thinking of what God values, walking the path that God walked. It's about thinking of others first, our community, our responsibilities, for such a life truly reflects that the law of God has been written on our hearts. Let us guard our hearts, for it is the wellspring of life.